It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later this hour, a conversation with Deirdre Dejeer. She's the Democratic candidate facing Paul Pate for Iowa's Secretary of State. But first, well, Russia's apparent continued use of Facebook to meddle in U.S. elections is only one example of how digital technology is changing political campaigns, political culture. This half hour, we want to discuss more broadly a number of communication trends in digital technology in this midterm campaign. Joining us to do that, David Karp is Associate Professor of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University and in the District of Columbia. David Karp, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's just start off and throw you this. So when we look at politics and digital media, what are you seeing that most interests you at the moment?
I think the thing that interests me most at the moment is the way that the big platforms, Google, Facebook, Twitter, have now been around long enough that political campaigns, both in the United States and abroad, trying to influence the United States, can get their bearings and try to figure out how to use them. It used to be that every 2 or 4 years when an election rolled around, there was some new technology that everyone was trying to figure out. Now that we've kind of got a stable set of technologies, we've got campaigns figuring out how to exploit them, and it's kind of not going well.
Mm-hmm. Right. What I mentioned there, the apparent Russian continued meddling here. I wonder when we had Facebook come out and these other social media, the Russians figured this out. Did we know? How good is our forecasting about how these technologies can be used when it takes quite a bit of lag time for those to get on board?
It's hard to say because it depends on how we're measuring it. And also these technologies, as we try to use them, it's easier to use them for harm than good in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentally, in elections, you're going to have a day on a Tuesday in November where everyone turns out to vote. And many people already know who they're going to vote for. They already know that they're going to vote. And so a lot of the communications happening on Facebook, happening on Twitter, don't actually move those votes. That said, what all of this online communication can do is create a lot of chaos and uncertainty during the election period that affects the agenda, affects what stories get told. And we're getting increasingly concerned that they can actually meddle with the elections themselves. That type of cyber attack is something that I don't believe we've seen yet, but we're now getting more and more worried about.
Mm-hmm. So when you look at the various online platforms, where do you look for the sort of cutting edge of political persuasion? I mean, Facebook has been in the spotlight in the news for sure, but what else do you see? Or is it Facebook?
Well, so for a long time, again, if we're talking about persuasion is really hard in campaigns. The thing that Facebook was probably most useful for in 2016 was actually fundraising. So that's not convincing people to support Trump over Clinton. It's convincing people who support Trump to buy an extra Trump hat or give some extra money. And the Trump campaign was fantastically effective at that. In terms of actual persuasion effects, it's unclear whether digital ads make a big difference. It's also unclear whether or not TV ads make a big difference. We sort of get hit with a lot of advertising, and that affects the course of the campaign, but it's never clear how many votes that actually moves.
Mm-hmm. What about agitation? What I'm getting from the coverage is that, this meddling, this chaos creation is taking our political extremes, making that divide seem larger than it is, or perhaps, in fact, making that divide larger than it is.
Yeah, that's where we're now seeing it. We're seeing these Russian accounts helping to start protests and counter-protests that actually turn people out into the streets so that they can yell at each other more loudly. Now, that's tapping into divisions that already exist in the United States, but it's also exacerbating them and helping to make them the story.
Mm-hmm. Who are the people really engaged politically online?
I'd say actually the people engaged online at this point in history are probably older than you and your listeners would think.
Meaning what?
Meaning that Facebook's user base is not a bunch of kids. It's not a bunch of 20-somethings.
Right.
If you're talking about...
I know that because teenagers I know think Facebook is really uncool.
There it is, yeah. Now, if you go to a place like Reddit, if you go to a place like 4chan, where they're often creating a lot of this content, that's going to skew younger. But the people who are paying attention to politics have always tended to be older and more established. And that remains true online today, since now pretty much everyone is online.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you look at this purported continued Russian meddling, what do you see as the future there? Can we behave differently in our social media, on Facebook? Is it changing behavior because we're taking in this news at the same time we may be sharing things about our family or political things on Facebook or Twitter or other platforms?
So it's a little early to say. The one thing that has seemed like a positive contribution so far is I think Facebook is now taking this very seriously in a way that they weren't in 2016. In 2016, a number of people pointed to the fact that Facebook accepted some political advertising in rubles as, you know, evidence of, hey, they were asleep at the wheel. And my thinking at the time was, you know, it's a really big company. Why would you have someone who's charged with checking what denominations advertisements are coming in for until you know that you have a problem? I think in 2016, they didn't know and we didn't know how big of a problem this was about to be. And that means that they didn't staff up for it. They didn't have policies and procedures for it. And to their credit, I think the scandal of the past, God, we're getting into a year and a half now, has been large enough that they are now trying to figure out what to do with this. Now, it's a hard problem. It's not going to go great. It's not going to be pretty. But this announcement that we just got 2 days ago about them kicking fake Russian users off the site, that's not a thing that would have happened in 2016 because they wouldn't have been staffed up to look. So I think they are taking it seriously, but it's a hard problem, and I think 2018 is just going to be a chaotic mess.
Yeah, and when we look at the hard problem Facebook and other social media are using, I mean, you want to kick off abusers, but how do you define abuse? Where is the line between you want to allow free speech, right? But you don't want to have this sort of incitement from powers abroad?
That's right. And I would actually say not just powers abroad. One of the challenges for Facebook and Google and all the platforms is in their early days, I think they were able to construct themselves with an assumption that people would behaving in earnestness. That when someone expresses an opinion about politics or civics online, whether we like that opinion or not, we ought to support them saying it because it's a marketplace of ideas and everyone must mean what they say. And now that these sites have gotten big and also there's big money in these sites, what we've now increasingly seen is people aren't saying things from an earnest perspective. They're saying it to troll. They're saying it in order to attract attention and make money off of that attention. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, the through line of the story that came out in October 2016 about Macedonian teenagers who were operating fake news sites. They were doing that because manufacturing fake outrage was leading to a bunch of clicks that was then leading to money. They were making tens of thousands of dollars off of our fake outrage.
Mm-hmm.
So once that fake outrage, once you get real money behind fake outrage, the companies need to stop assuming earnestness. And that's a real challenge for them because if fake news is coming from domestic actors, that doesn't make it okay. Just this past week, they've taken some actions against Alex Jones, who's a famous conspiracy theorist who has been saying for years that the Parkland shooting didn't really happen and sending his supporters to harass the parents of the Parkland teens. The teens in Connecticut. That is a real problem that Facebook has avoided addressing under that assumption of earnestness. And I think they're just now starting to realize, wait, this is just a performance that also pollutes society. And we're a big enough platform that we actually have to have some new policies for dealing with it.
Mm-hmm. You said it'd be a difficult challenge. Do you see, if you were advising Facebook or someone else in that position as a social media giant, what would you say is the way forward?
I would say that they need to stop. They need to start by no longer assuming earnestness. And that means listening to users who are reporting something as fake news and then penalizing fake news when they see it. That means that a site that is constantly manufacturing conspiracy theories maybe doesn't get banned right away, but at the very least probably gets downgraded because it's releasing conspiracy theories. And Facebook, as a private company, doesn't need to promote that sort of activity. And in fact, if they try to stay neutral, then what that ends up meaning is, in practice, they end up promoting that sort of activity.
I'm speaking with media and public affairs scholar David Karp from George Washington University about the intersection of technology and politics as we are less than 100 days away from the midterm elections. David, when we talk about what is new right now, what you were just talking about, so who is using, in the right way, technology for a campaign that you see as really effective?
One of the things that I've seen that's been very effective early on, there's been a number of Democratic candidates who have been releasing these just fantastic television advertisements that are designed not only to appeal to supporters within their district, but also to be shared through Facebook and through Twitter in order to increase their national prominence and get volunteers and get small donations from across the country. I think they've done a really nice job of understanding that now that we're in an era of social media sharing, they can produce these high-quality stories that appeal to a national public instead of just putting together short ads that are locally focused and they spend a lot of money to put it on the air locally.
Right, and it reminds me almost in the early days of music videos on MTV. Mm-hmm. For instance, the video I'm sure you've seen multiple times, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez right. Of Queens. We see this great music. We see her on a mass transit platform, changing from commuter shoes to high heels and so forth. So this is what you mean.
Yeah. That was a brilliant ad designed not just for her district. It's designed also for her district, but it's designed in order to be shared because it tells a compelling story and has a compelling message that people can then share through social media. Now, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that advertisement would have been less valuable in politics because we didn't have the same social media sharing ecology. And so that ad, like an ad that good, just wouldn't have had such an impact.
Mm-hmm. So let's take an ad that you would make for social media, compare that to one you would buy on traditional television. How are they different? How is their effectiveness different, as you can see?
The traditional television ads, the way you try to extend their life and their reach is by making them something that is going to spark outrage on the nightly news, or coverage at least on the nightly news. So that can be some sort of a like nasty attack that leads to coverage. One thing that really comes to mind is back in 2004, there were the Swift boat ads against John Kerry.
Mm-hmm.
Those were actually only aired a few times, but they were designed to be aired a few times and then unleash conversation and repeat coverage through the national news, which meant repeat exposure, which meant it became one of the fixtures of the campaign, despite not actually dropping a lot of money to have it on the air all the time. So I think in the broadcast media era, what made for a good ad was something that was going to become a conversation point through television news and maybe through the newspaper. And now the better ads are the ones that become conversation points through sharing online, because TV news and newspaper are watching the online conversation and using that to help shape their agenda.
Mm-hmm. When we take an ad like that by Ocasio-Cortez, are they meant to persuade or are they preaching to the choir, just making you feel good if you are of that political persuasion, a Democratic socialist as she is?
Right. Well, I think in her case in particular, since she's running in a primary, they're meant to persuade primary voters that she's a candidate that they should be excited about. So that is tailored to her district, and it's meant to persuade. But if she was running that in a general election, she wouldn't be running that in order to persuade a bunch of moderate Republicans to vote for her. She's putting forward a clear ideology and showing a clear personality that is attractive to primary voters.
Mm-hmm. Our political landscape at this time is crazy in a lot of ways.
Uh-huh.
No news there. What connections do you see between this digital revolution, the things that you are studying, and the upheaval in our politics?
So there are a lot of linkages. The one thing that I would caution people, though, is while I think this change in digital technology, this digital revolution, certainly plays a supporting role in both how bad and how weird things have gotten. It's not the central player. Part of what we're now seeing, just yesterday I saw reporting about this QAnon conspiracy theory where the conspiracy theorists are now showing up at Trump rallies,
right,
holding up signs and wearing T-shirts. The most bizarre conspiracy theories on the internet are now bleeding over into public life in the real world.
Right, and QAnon, I saw this report as well. QAnon is the epitome of umbrella conspiracy theories, right?
It looks at the last craziest conspiracy theory, and to use an internet meme, says, "Hold my beer, I can go stronger than that."
Right.
You could not come up with a crazier conspiracy theory. The latest is QAnon. This conspiracy theory thinks that both Hillary Clinton and Tom Hanks are personally running a giant pedophilia ring. That's bizarre to the point of, like, they've made it all the way around the world back to comedy. It's so strange.
Right, and we have people turning up at serious political rallies with QAnon T-shirts.
Yes, yes, and now, believing that the Mueller investigation is going to is actually a false front that's going to lead to the arrest of all the pedophile Democrats. This is a claim that they are making on the internet and now making in the real world. So the internet's playing a role in that, certainly, but a lot of what's driving this politics is, in fact, the political actors themselves. We've had a long-term trend in politics of treating politics as though it's nothing but entertainment and nothing but a game, as if policymaking and governance don't matter at all. And if we treat policymaking and government and governance as something that doesn't matter, as something that's just light entertainment, then eventually that invites people to treat politics as they do sports, and root for their team and just root against the other team. And any bad information about your team needs to be dismissed because really the other team are the bad guys. I can believe terrible conspiracy theories about the Boston Celtics specifically because they beat my team in the playoffs and therefore I feel pent-up rage. And at the end of the day, I can do that because I know it doesn't matter. It's just basketball. But we're now taking those same habits and applying them to politics and to governance because we've stopped treating governance as though it's about anything real, as if it really affects people's lives. And I think the natural endpoint, if you follow that habit far enough, is people start believing crazy conspiracy theories and then acting on them because it's all a game, nothing matters, and the line between reality and fiction just kind of blurs.
David Karp, final few minutes with David, Associate Professor of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University. Of course, in journalism, we're very concerned about the rise of fake news. I know that can be defined in a couple of different ways, either news that you disagree with or news that has no factual basis to it. Will we, in the digital world, ever get back, as far as you can see, to a world where we more or less agree on basic facts? Or are we going to be living in our own individual silos, creating our own realities with varying degrees of relevance to what I'll just say is reality?
I would say it certainly is going to get worse before it gets better. And I personally don't yet have confidence that it will get better. The old era where we could all agree on the basic facts was an era of information scarcity where you had a small number of gatekeeping institutions, CBS News, NPR, both stand in as gatekeeping institutions, that set the agenda for the entire nation. And actually before the internet, just with the rise of cable television, the cable spectrum, we started to see a broadening of niche storytelling and niche news that allowed people who didn't want to listen to the original gatekeepers to find different gatekeepers. The internet just accelerated that, so now everyone can find gatekeepers that they like. They still do encounter news that they didn't want to see because everyone's on Facebook and or on social media, and your friends from high school will be sharing stuff that doesn't match your political persuasion. So it's not that we're all hidden within our own information cocoons, but it's certainly the case that we're now able to self-select more effectively the gatekeepers that we would like to help serve up the political agenda to us or the news agenda. And so long as that keeps on happening, it's going to be very difficult. It's going to be very chaotic. Working all of that out, I'm not hopeful that we have it all worked out in the next 5 years, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 10 years or 20 years.
So technology, you're saying, is not the driver here. What is the driver using technology?
I would say that both our political elites and the elites in our news environment need to take their jobs more seriously and act like this stuff matters. When we have elected officials just constantly pretending that the only thing that's at stake is the next election, right, that is both bad for the country and also encourages us to go down this path of constantly just rooting for our team. Like, it used to be that if something like a big healthcare bill or a big immigration bill was getting debated, you would have everyone coming together and actually debating what good policy would be. They don't do that anymore. And if they don't do that, and if the news, when covering it, just treats it as, well, what's this going to mean for the next election, and doesn't talk about the real consequences for real human beings, then that encourages a behavior of saying, well, you know what, this is just entertainment, so I can tune out, or if I'm going to tune in, I should tune into the stations that tell the stories that are fun for me to hear. Mm-hmm. QAnon is a really fun story to hear if you are of a certain perspective on Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. So what can we as individuals, people who are not in the media newsmakers, what advice do you have? What power do consumers of media have at this point to turn it back to a more healthy consumption of information, digestion of information and news to have an informed democracy?
There's a few things they can do. On an individual level, you should be aware of where your news is coming from. Think hard about what gatekeepers you're trusting. And when those gatekeepers behave badly, you should try to shame them. You know, if you think that the news is doing a bad job of covering politics as though it matters, you should be tweeting at them and sending angry notes to them on Facebook saying, look, I expect more from you. You need to take your work seriously. And beyond that, I think we need to act collectively. You know, individuals shaping their own news environment can get them better news, but isn't going to fix society. We need to,
right,
as a citizenry, demand that we treat governance as though it matters.
Right. Very quickly, we don't have much time, but are you saying we should not cover QAnon?
I'm saying that if we're going to cover QAnon, we need to make sure that we're covering what's really at stake there, and not just ending it with, and hey, will this matter at all for the upcoming election? Because that's a game frame, and we need to talk about the real politics, the real policy. Also, if we're going to cover QAnon, we should also make sure that we're still covering the migrant children who are being separated by their families, because that's important, too.
Okay, very good. Thanks for this time with us. David Karp is the Associate Professor of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University. Thank you for joining us from our nation's capital, David.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up in just a moment, a conversation with Deidre DeGeer. She's the Democratic candidate facing Paul Pate, Republican Paul Pate, for Iowa Secretary of State. She is the first African-American candidate to be nominated in a major political party for statewide office in Iowa. She's coming up, a conversation with Deidre DeGeer after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.